that's one of the ways we, you know, have helped a leading brand sell into China. And so it's a proven model, you know, it's a proven case study. And I don't think, you know, enough U.S. companies had really exploited that market. And, you know, I would have said a couple of years ago, instead of complaining about China, how about giving it a shot and trying to sell into China? Because there's a massive market and there's an appetite for proven brands, brands with some cachet, brands that already have a presence in the U.S. and Europe. And so from an operational standpoint, that's what we did. That's about 10 to 15% of our business. The remaining is sourcing and supply chain.
That's my guest, David Alexander, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
David Alexander is the founder and CEO of BaySource Global. BaySource Global is a sourcing, procurement, and project management firm with a focus on middle market companies. BaySource Global provides on-the-ground sourcing, engineering, and quality control expertise for companies who may lack the resources, personnel, or infrastructure to successfully execute projects in China. BaySource Global was founded in 2005 and operates in Tampa, Florida, and Shanghai, China. Today, I'm talking to David from his office in Tampa, Florida. David Alexander, thank you for being my guest today. Welcome to Reliability Matters.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Oh, it's my pleasure. BaySource Global, your company that you founded 15 years ago, I believe, your business is to basically assist companies that want to purchase goods from China or sell goods into China. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So when I think of China, I think of the ability for U.S. and other nation companies to purchase low-cost goods. But with China now the second largest economy in the world, second only to the U.S., what are the opportunities to sell to China? I understand your company does both, and that surprised me, because when I think of China, I don't think of selling there. I think of buying from there. So is there a market for U.S. goods in China?
Yeah, so great question. And I probably would have answered differently 6 months ago before, you know, tariffs and trade wars had really manifested into our psyches and into our business ethos. Certainly, as you mentioned, there's a massive market there. So let's start with an example of one of our clients who we had been sourcing components for years. They're in the fitness industry, and they have a well-known brand presence here in the United States and a niche product. And they said, you know, the fitness industry's kind of, the movement is booming with the millennials and Gen Xers in China now. So wouldn't it make sense that we can sell our equipment to, you know, gyms, hotels, institutional users, consumers? And certainly it was the case. And because they did have a staid brand in the U.S., anyone with an internet connection could see that they are leaders in this particular space. And so we helped them go from zero to 8 million in sales in 2 years. Wow. Now, we didn't do that by being sales and marketing experts. We, you know, required that they fund their own sales and marketing team, a small team. And what we were able to do is more on the coordination and supply chain side. So we're able to set up third-party logistics for them. We helped build out their web presence fully in Chinese. Of course, do, you know, transact in RMB versus US dollars. We man a 24/7 chat window, kind of a chat bot online. And if, you know, if you're in China, you're shopping on Taobao and, you know, the Tmall and those kind of sites. And so we really are the back office support, administration, finance, accounting, hosting. So we host their sales group and then the 3PL. And then their equipment goes out to CrossFit events. So we help them take their you know, 30 or 40 units to a CrossFit expo or event, the equipment's used, and then it's all under the brand. The brand is a big sponsor of the CrossFit event, and then bring that equipment back. So that's one of the ways we, you know, have helped a leading brand sell into China. And so it's a proven model, you know, it's a proven case study. And I don't think, you know, enough U.S. companies had really exploited that market. And, you know, I would have said a couple of years ago, instead of complaining about China, how about giving it a shot and trying to sell into China? Because there's a massive market and there's an appetite for proven brands, brands with some cachet, brands that already have a presence in the U.S. and Europe. And so from an operational standpoint, that's what we did. That's about 10 to 15% of our business. The remaining is sourcing and supply chain.
Yeah. Yeah. I think China is definitely very quickly becoming a consumer market, much like the U.S. is. You know, our economy is largely based on consumer, where China's economy, historically anyway, recent historic, has always been based on manufacturing and exporting. So it's going to be interesting to see that transition as more Chinese citizens are becoming successful. They're getting some degree of monetary success. They are going to want to purchase, as you said, those exercise products and cars and things that perhaps they weren't able to do formerly. It's going to be interesting to see as the years go by how much. The irony is manufacturing created that new wealth. Will that new wealth damage manufacturing? Will they become more consumer oriented than manufacturing oriented? That's just going to be an interesting transition. Here's a compound question. What are the risks in purchasing from China? And are those risks similar to purchasing products from any other country? Or are there risks, if any, unique to China?
Yeah, so I always come at this question by first addressing what the concerns have always been, and that is quality and intellectual property theft. And one, if somebody tells you they can protect your IP, run from that person as fast as you can, because you essentially can't. It's important to register your marks, your trademarks, your patents in the countries where they're being manufactured, whether that's Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, China, the US, anywhere. That's a significant consideration for anyone. Quality, though, is, you know, I often say, whether you're manufacturing in Chicago or Chengdu, if you're contract manufacturing something, you need to manage that process. And so that's all we're doing. It's not that difficult. We have the day-to-day presence at the suppliers, making sure that they are adhering to, you know, first of all, conforming to the right materials, and in some cases, very clearly spec'd out materials, as well as, manufacturing for fit and function, and then overseeing the in-house testing or the post-production testing, either required by certification and safety or just by the brand. When the product comes over, our clients' customers have to be happy, and our clients have to help us put together that quality manual. And no matter if you're producing one SKU or 1,000 SKUs, you've got to have quality manuals and processes in place. And that's what we do. We manage that through the life cycle of a product.
Very good. It's nice to hear a candid reply to, you know, what are the risks in going to China? Because some people will say, absolutely not. And some people will say it can never be done. And it is kind of an elephant in the room, and still companies are making a success of it. So with China's growth rate slowing, part of it due to COVID-19 and other factors, and their labor rates, while still comparatively quite low, their labor rates are slowly rising. As prices from China slowly begin to rise, or costs from China slowly begin to rise, what country could be the next China?
That is a big, long 2-hour question that I'll try to cover. So first of all, I still believe China will be factory to the world for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. Is that 5 years or 10 years? I don't know. Nobody's got the crystal ball. I do think one of the things we learned with COVID, even in my position where I thought I knew what and what was not being manufactured over there, was some of our pharma. So I learned, you know, in the last couple of months, even penicillin, the active ingredient in penicillin was being made over there. Why would that be? You know, if we talk about job creation, and I know that was, you know, this administration's whole platform for getting elected was bringing jobs back. Why wouldn't we have some of the critical essential needs being made over here, even if the costs were a bit higher? So forget consumer and forget industrial, pharma. And then, we saw PPE, and everybody's seen what's going on there. So I think that there will be some at-risk industries, whether it's technology and, you know, communication. And I think we'll see a lot of that come back here. I think there will be a movement to there will be a lack of a wholesale movement to let's get it made in China. So we're helping clients do RFPs, requests for pricing, in Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, India, Vietnam. Everybody knows and everybody's talking about Vietnam. Well, they predict by next year, well over 50% of the available labor force will be taken up in Vietnam. And a lot of that, surprisingly, is by the Chinese, who will want their low value add services and labor intense production move to Vietnam. So you see Chinese guys, wealthy factory owners who, you know, have done well over the last, you know, 20 years. Now they're moving their non-value add production to Vietnam. But we have to remember that no country has the infrastructure that China has,
right,
in terms of highways, transportation, technology, you know, communications technology. Many sophisticated Chinese suppliers are using ERP systems and not just scratching things in a book or even using just basic Excel. So I guess the point is Vietnam is kind of looks like China did, I don't know, 15 years ago. Some very well-known companies like Siemens has their largest manufacturing facility in Vietnam. So Vietnam can do it. It just comes down to a lot of things, including lead time. And again, that quality and that technology transfer and learning curve. So it's taken us, 25 years to kind of transfer some of our quality processes, even some human welfare, you know, requirements that you would find like OSHA having jurisdiction over. So it's taken this long. So we're not going to move entire supply chains overnight. I know that's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. So your company wrote a blog. I'm not sure if you wrote it or someone else in your company wrote it. 7 ways the made in China stereotype is changing. Was that yours? Was that your product there?
We have written about that.
Okay, good. We talked about this a little bit, but what was the stereotype and how has it changed?
Well, the first stereotype, of course, is cost. Cheap products from China. And so over the past dozen years, you know, China has added additional layers of, let's just call it overhead, whether that's social costs. So employers have to pay in for social costs. That can be, you know, health and welfare costs so that the government isn't paying entirely for everybody's retirement or you know, care, you know, post-retirement. And so you've got these layers of overhead and salaries, of course, have risen, especially in the managerial level. But I think, Mike, it still comes down to that hourly wage. So if something does not have a lot of labor in the manufacturing of that product, it's certainly not shouldn't be a candidate for China. Labor is the deciding factor in all of this. We know that. We've known that since we started going to China. But I think what you're seeing now is less of a massive wave of let's move, shut a factory down in Canada or the U.S. and move that factory to China, and much more about new product startup. That's where I think the play is going to be for China for a long time, because so many of these assets are in place. you know, whether it was China's 2008 stimulus package or cheap money, there every type of manufacturing discipline under the sun is in China, whether that's simple cut and sew or plush toys to sophisticated electromechanical products. And as you know, Mike, a lot of the supply chain is in China. Like, take LED lights as an example. That started basically in China. So we haven't opened up all these new LED factories here in the United States. That supply chain for those type of products that may go into electronics or some of the things you see, you know, at Home Depot, that exists in China today. So I don't know how we move that. And, there, you know, whether it's private equity, or we're going to have to invest in assets here in the United States to bring manufacturing back.
Yeah, and we're gonna get into that in just a little bit. I travel to China fairly regularly, or at least I used to. Probably nothing compared to what you do. And one of the observations I have always come away with is, I think I'm pretty much convinced that everybody in China is an entrepreneur of some sort. Whether you're selling inner tubes, bicycle inner tubes on the corner, or running a big company, it seems like everyone has that entrepreneurial spirit, at least, and wants to be part of this, you know, big boom that's happened in the last 30, 40 years. And maybe that's a little different in quote unquote more developed countries. China's in many ways way more developed than we are, but I think Western countries that have had manufacturing authority for the last 100 years or more, we tend to grow up and take that for granted. And I think maybe when it's a newer culture exposed to the ability to become successful, everyone wants a piece of that now. And I don't know if that's something you've noticed or not, but that's certainly the takeaway I've had. Anytime I have meetings in China with employees of a customer, they are working quite hard as if it's their company. And I don't know, that's kind of the takeaway I've had when I visited there.
Yeah, I certainly see the entrepreneurial spirit prevalent in China. And, you know, when China was brought into the WTO, World Trade Association, around the year 2000, game was on, right? So everybody wanted in, and that's why you had, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of factories, people that write about China, you know, especially back around 2005 to 2010, talk about their first trip to China, and an endless, as far as the eye could see, array of cranes, which meant building, which meant factories, which meant development. And, you know, I often say that, you know, China's not really a Christian country, but money is their God.
Right.
And I don't mean to make a blanket statement. That's not in any way disparaging Chinese. But you know, and I also tell people, if somebody's going to try to use an inferior material in your product, it's nothing personal. If you haven't spec'd it out, you know, that's not our fault. We're going to get, if the toy car says, you know, if they say paint it blue, we're going to paint it blue.
With lead.
But it may have lead in
that.
Unless
you say no lead. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You get what you ask for. Or you get what you don't ask
for. That's right.
Yeah. So you were part of a panel of experts that contributed to an article entitled, "Warning: Experts Predict These Supply Chain Changes Are... Needed to survive." So tell me about that. What, particularly in the context of a global pandemic, what supply changes are needed?
Another big question. So
we have hours, David. Things... We have hours and hours.
So one of the things I think I mentioned was, you know, one of the catchphrases in industry has been just in time. JIT, you know, right. lean manufacturing, just in time. And I think JIT is going to move to JIC, which is just in case. So I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. I'm saying that there might be additional safety stocks of critical, you know, essential materials. So there might be, companies might look at their free cash flow a little bit differently, their inventory on hand differently. Again, when it comes to critical healthcare products, but certainly people are going to be looking away from China. And anecdotally, I have a friend in the automotive industry. He's a broker rep to the big guys in Detroit, and so he has a line of companies he represents. And one of those companies has shifted production to Croatia, and he got invited on a trip to go over there. And you know, just like you would go to China and visit factory, he goes over there and he walks the factory floor, and they're like, "Hey, send us more business. Send us more business. You know, quality is no problem. If you need PPAP or whatever automotive, you know, requirements for quality are required, we'll put that in. ISO, no problem." So you're going to see a shift to other countries. I do think parts of Eastern Europe, I know that Mexico is going to be a big one. People have always kind of been reluctant to go to Mexico, but I think that even with the border situation, Mexico is going to be looking for ways to continue to add jobs, which I think will shift the quality paradigm. I mean, quality is one of the reasons people didn't go to Mexico, and frankly, safety, you know, but I see that shifting.
Yeah, I've seen I'm in Southern California, so not far south of me are all the maquiladora programs that go on just south of the U.S. border in Mexico. And I've witnessed over many years, when China started becoming the dominant manufacturing company, U.S. companies and others who set up factories in Mexico moved to China. And one of the questions I'm going to ask you in a few minutes is about reshoring. I've seen kind of a strange version of reshoring coming back to Mexico. And it's not, you know, reshoring in a classic sense where it comes back to the country that, where the company is located. But I've seen things leave Mexico, come back to Mexico. And this was several years ago. This is before a pandemic and other things. This was mainly due to the logistics of, you know, Mexico. If you're in the United States, Mexico is, you know, rock's throw south of here. They mostly share similar time zones to the U.S. Because they're attached, you know, on our continent. And it's kind of the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't know. And I don't mean any of these are enemies, but it just suggests that, yeah, we know what the problems are in Mexico. And China, you know, 20 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago, was still a work in progress. It was a moving target. And I remember when China had the Olympics, they pushed out companies because they needed to clean the air up. And I know people who've co-owned factories there. And, you know, one day you're in a zone for a factory and one day you're not in a zone for a factory. And because the government, local government wanted to change the landscape of that area. So I think the moving target part of China, which is, I think, less now than it was before, caused people to take a second look. They really had to save a lot of money for it to be worth all the other risks and hassles. But I think that's largely changed. That was my perception many years ago. I think probably their infrastructure is so much better and their government's a little bit more in control of the local governments so that things like that don't happen. And the amount of graft, the amount of bribes are probably, I'm guessing, lower now maybe than they were kind of in the Wild West days when China manufacturing was growing very, very quickly. Is that your interpretation as well, or do you have a different take on that?
Yeah, so I think corruption and graft, when President Xi took power, I think he did a wonderful job of rebranding China to the Chinese. He got rid of layers of corrupt officials, and he discontinued banquet-style meals and expensive cars for government officials. He did a really good job. He understood that this next generation would not put up with. And he knew that he had to win the hearts of the people. And there is more nationalism now than ever before in China. Chinese are very proud now. I think there was a big question mark for a while there. So good for Xi for doing that. I will say, Mike, that a lot of what we're talking about today is contract manufacturing. I have a widget or a set of widgets or some assemblies, and I need these to be made at the lowest possible total landed cost. I'm going to get them made in China. If you have a joint venture in China, you have assets in China, or you partner with another investor, another factory owner in China, and it's very complex to do business, particularly cease doing business. So we have services we call wind down. If you don't wind down a business, you can't just shut the doors. The government could shut the doors, but if you as a private owner are hemorrhaging money, you want to just shut the doors, you can't do that. In Mexico, it's very easy to do. You can just shut the doors next week if you want. And I think that's one of the reasons you're going to see larger corporate enterprises consider Mexico. Whereas in China, you might have to pay a half a year to a year of payroll before you even think about shutting the doors. And if you don't do that, they'll make your life miserable. They'll flag your products, any remaining products. You could have, six figures or more in transit waiting to ship. They'll make sure those products don't ship. That you've heard horror stories about them, taking friendly hostages. So the American or the Western guy comes over and the employees are sniffing that you're shutting their factory down. They know that because their cousin up the street makes the same product. And now somebody has sent, drawings or designs or specs to that company. And they talk. As big as China is, it's also
very connected.
Very connected. That's right. And so it's challenging from that standpoint. So, yeah, I think Mexico will definitely open up some opportunities.
Kind of a contrast in China, the owner of a business can't just shut down a business, their own business, but the government can. Here in this country, the owner can shut down a business pretty much anytime they want, and the government really can't for the most part, without a lot of effort. So it's just completely the inverse of that. So let's talk about the huge elephant in the universe right now, which is the global pandemic, COVID-19. What have we learned from the COVID-19 pandemic with regards to supply chain? If we've learned anything, or if I'm sure we're still in the process of learning, but what direction do you think we're going with regard to supply chain post-pandemic?
Well, I mentioned just in case instead of just in time.
Yeah.
I also want to point one thing out before I kind of answer your question, is that this pandemic came on the heels of the Chinese New Year. So
we dodged a bullet with that, didn't we?
We kind of did.
Because we stock up. We know it closes. So
that's correct.
Yeah.
That is the necessary evil of having products made in China. So it did not have quite the impact, nor did it have the impact on Chinese society, because they were already migrating to their hometowns and, sequestering and getting with family and having meals and celebrating and doing all that thing. I'm wondering how well they would have handled the pandemic, with the quarantining, if this was in, say, starting right now in June.
Right.
I don't know if their numbers would have been what they were. But back to our supply chains, I think we're going to really move to trying to understand what is essential. There has to be a lot more financial analysis done on carrying cost of capital for excess inventory, non-moving inventory, safety stocks, things like that. I also think that in this pandemic, there will be fewer Chinese factories. So the guy that was just barely keeping his head above water, maybe his only profits were coming through VAT tax. He's probably done now. So you're going to see a little bit of cream rising to the top. Now, that said, if China starts losing a lot of volume and a lot of export dollars, I'm wondering out loud in here today with you, will they start extending terms. So right now there are basically no terms in China. You pay 50% of the value of the purchase order when you place that purchase order, and then they expect 50% X works, or when the product's leaving the factory. And that puts a crunch on cash flow, especially when you're ordering hundreds of thousand dollars of product at a time. So I think a lot more financial analysis is going to go into what that means for businesses, looking at, their available cash flow and investing in inventory that might sit longer. But I also think some of the decision makers in China might start extending terms. I don't know. It's a little soon to tell. This is sort of innuendo at this point.
Yeah, I think what word I'm hearing more now in the midst of the pandemic is a look at diversification of the supply chain. You talk about just in case, people may stock up higher quantities in inventory. They may duplicate some of the manufacturing efforts in other countries, part of the just in case mentality. I think that other countries are going to get some kind of benefit as manufacturers start to at least consider diversification. I'm sure that's not possible in every manufacturing case, but certainly in some cases, if it can be built in China, it can be built in Malaysia, or it could be built in Vietnam, or perhaps India. So I see a little bit of that coming our way. But I do agree, if this pandemic had emerged on the world scene today, I know our industry, which is so reliant on components, electrical components, electronic components coming out of China, we would have been in far worse shape than we actually were. We did see an expansion of delivery times starting around March, and parts that would take 3 weeks took 6 weeks, but not enough to shut down our industry. We had enough inventory, fortunately, because we were gearing up for the Chinese New Year, that we did dodge a huge bullet there. But I think one time we dodge a bullet, the second time the bullet has a better aim. So with some experts predicting a rebound of COVID-19, particularly as the world is starting to open back up again, history will tell us if we're opening up too soon or too late. I know in several U.S. states, we're seeing an increase in infections again as they partially opened up. Do you think we're ready as an industry if we get COVID-19, part two? Mm-hmm. Or are we still so deep in this trying to figure out, what to do?
Well, I think our own industry is going to look a lot different, right? Provision of face masks and, PPE, eye shields and all that thing, to social distancing in any manufacturing or assembly facilities here. We've got to do some of the things that China did, including, even in offices, everybody entering an office building had to get their temperature checked. And as you probably know, there's even some sort of an RF code system in China, which shows that you are not in quarantine, or how they administer this to 1.3 billion people's beyond me.
Cell phones. But, yeah, you have a green or a red on your cell phone. If you travel to an area, they do geo tracking. If you travel to an area with known infections, then your green status might go to red for 2 weeks. It's
absolutely. Yeah. And people are publicly shamed if they're in violation of that, then they'll call you out. The Chinese, whereas here in the US, we're not doing those kinds of things. We're 50-50 split on, should we wear PPE or not in public? And
sure. Is it pandemic or plandemic? I mean, you get both sides here. Certainly it originated, supposedly, according to the scientists, this COVID originated in China. And one can perhaps rightly put some blame on the local Chinese officials who denied there was a problem until the federal government or their main government figured out there was a problem. So we can blame China a little bit for delaying, but we can also thank China a lot for coming up with the methods to mitigate it and to, put that horrible virus back in a box. But I think that even though we can learn from it, they did things that only China could do, only an authoritarian government can do. I don't think the U.S. or most Western countries even if they wanted to, could get away with, and I don't mean get away as if they've done something wrong, but they, with the audacity to force people into fever clinics when they're when they have a fever and make them take their temperatures before they go into any public space. I think our society, our culture, our constitution, all those things just prevent that from happening. So I think our journey and most Western nations' journey with this virus is going to be considerably longer than the source country for this virus, you know, just because of their ability to do things that we societally can't do. So I give China a lot of credit for all the methods, these huge methods that they, almost draconian, because it, that's what it took to put that thing back in a box in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, you know, I'll share a quick story. Early February, a lady that works for me, she and I got on a WeChat call on some details, and she kind of changed the subject. She said, "I'm really worried about you." I said, "What are you talking about? We're good, you know. We're." It was early February. I'm like, "No, we're fine. What are you worried about? You know, it's probably not going to make it too big a way here." As she knew, her instinctive, she said, and I said, "Why?" And this was several texts, because you Americans take your freedom too seriously, and so I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten her and her angst. That morning, and instinctively she knew that we were going to have an issue here, and that's interesting, right? And again, anecdotally, how she understood, and she's traveled here before, so she gets us, and she was right, you know. Whereas they locked it down, and I remember when, you know, when the numbers really started spiking here, there was even a question as to who could get tested, who could afford to be tested. Whereas in China, there was no question. You go get tested. You don't pay anything to get tested. It's not, you know, what healthcare plan are you on, a PPO or an HMO. You go get tested. And that's that. And, you know, the proofs, you know, you mentioned Wuhan at the beginning of this section of our discussion. And yes, there was absolutely an effort by a local government. Now, Wuhan is a big city, right? But there was an effort locally to contain and hope to contain this, because those local officials would be certainly reprimanded, if right. not, you know, in prison. So
it was the ultimate CYA at that moment.
Yeah. There was a week to two. I would say there was a week to two lag there in disclosure, but only when the central government got involved did things get serious. And they, like you said, they really did put it in a box. You know, now I don't agree with the numbers that they're reporting. So Shanghai, city of 24 million, essentially an area, a province of 24 million people. If you're going to tell me there were only 600 cases in Shanghai, I'm calling baloney on that.
Yeah.
But we do see that they are back to work, and schools are open again. As of, we have a lady in our office, kids just went back to school here last week. So it has been a long, methodical process to reopen, but factories had reopened, and we have a story of one of our factories. One of our suppliers did a wonderful job doing a pictorial on a day in the life of their factories. They showed pictures of the employees getting temperature checked. They showed employees wearing PPE. They even showed them fumigating the wood crates that these products, these are large LED signs, mm-hmm. and they were fumigating the crates so that if there was any concern, you know, about the 30-day transit and the virus's ability to survive that, that they were going to at least do their part on that end. So, yeah, they took it a lot more seriously than we have.
So I've noticed in my life, if I order something online or if I am asking a company to provide a service, the excuse for everything now when something doesn't arrive on time or the service isn't performed properly is, "Oh, well, sir, COVID." So it's the poster child now for every excuse in the world. Sorry, COVID. So I'm starting to wonder if we're going to see an increase in prices due to or blamed, you know, as a result of COVID. I know a lot of countries, from a governmental standpoint, are putting in billions, if not trillions of dollars into all sorts of programs. I know a lot of companies are spending more money to stay in business under these trying times. How much of that, if there is a legitimate cost increase, and even if there's not a legitimate cost increase, if it's just used as an excuse, do you expect that prices in China or anywhere in the world will start creeping upward as a result of, or at least to blame COVID?
It's another big question, good question. I hate to go to Econ 101, but I think it's going to be simply supply and demand. So the internet has democratized consumption, so buying decisions. So anything can be looked up, right? So if I want a 32 or a 48 or a 60-inch flat panel TV, I can, in 5 minutes, you know, understand what the price point is on that. Even if it's for industrial supplies, I can very quickly see what's available and when. And so I think that's going to be industry by industry, where you might have a glut of automobiles right now because nobody was buying cars over the last 2 months. This might be the best time to buy a car.
Sure.
But longer term, yeah, I do think that our overheads are going to increase. It's yet to be seen, but I do think it goes sort of category by category, whether it's healthcare or, you know, medicine or auto parts. I mean, what do you think the cost of a hotel room in New York City is today versus, you know, January?
Oh, yeah, sure. You can probably stay at the Marquee at Times Square for you know, $100 a night right now when it's normally $800 a night or more.
But when those hotels are fully functional again or fully occupied at 60, 70, 80% again, I think you are going to have increased costs because you're going to have much more attention paid to housekeeping and hygiene. And that means buying more products that you didn't have before. That means hand sanitizing stations throughout any facility, right?
Sure.
There might be less availability. So you want to go to a football game instead of, you know, 60,000 people being able to go, only 30,000 are permitted in.
Right. It's going to be $30 hot dogs now instead of $15 hot dogs.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I don't know if people are going to want to touch their seat and then eat a hot dog with their hand.
Right.
We have a long way to go in this thing.
Yeah.
Until there's a vaccine. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. Do you think consumers are willing to pay extra costs if the product is made in their respective countries?
I hear that question a lot, and I just honestly think people vote with their wallets. That's end of that discussion. I know that there's a big subset. We could all go online and probably find websites devoted to Made in America, and, you know, people have scrutinized the components and parts that go into these things. And I used to get, you know, a long time ago, hate mail, because people would find us on the website and they would, you know, spout off about, you're the reason we're losing jobs, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to say to them, well, you just typed that message to me on a keyboard that was made in China.
Yeah, a lot of irony.
Looking at a screen that was made in China. And because the total package and price for what you could afford was what you could afford. So,
yeah, I think consumers are responsible for the situation.
Absolutely.
And it's because we demand lower prices. We don't demand value. We demand lower prices. And companies, you know, I think maybe with some exception, companies are amoral. You know, they're not immoral. They're not moral.
Yeah.
Companies respond to demand. And if the demand is a 70-inch OLED big screen TV for $89, that's where they're going to go. They're going to find a way to do it. I've always been amazed at, it's been a long time since I've used this analogy, so it's dated, but, you know, the last Blu-ray DVD player I ever bought, I bought from Walmart for $39. $39. Yeah. And it was made in China. And I know, just because I'm in the manufacturing business, I know that the manufacturer in China made it profitably. The distributor made it profitably. The shipping companies, you know, made money bringing it several thousand miles over to the U.S. And then Walmart made money running it through all their distribution centers. And it only was $39. So, you know, how cheap can things be made? But I do think that, you know, I'm like anyone else. I say, can I buy this here? And it's not really even an option anymore. I don't think you can buy a screen made in North America, period, even if you wanted to. And if you're willing to pay a 50% premium, I don't think they can still build them here, even with that type of premium. So, it's a new world now. I think that the days of going down to your corner store and buying from mom and pop, and, you know, those days, unfortunately, are behind us. Maybe some of it will return, and I hope some of it does. And I think there's a value in having some of it return just from a supply chain diversification, you know, just in case, as you say. You wrote about U.S. reshoring requiring a major investment in skilled jobs and training programs, most likely requiring government funding. It's such a large project. Do you think that's likely to happen?
Yes, I'm hopeful that that happens. And a lot of people would assume I'm pro-China manufacturing. I'm just pro-smart manufacturing. I want to see all of our businesses succeed. I've been scratching my head at this administration's trade war and collecting tariffs and duties on products. And does anyone really know where that money goes? Because I'm not sure. And scratching my head as to why a well thought out strategy and executed plan would have said that we're taking that money and we're offering federally funded programs for skilled jobs training that any state can apply for. And in some cases, you know, this will put 30 people to work in a small, you know, assembly shop or factory, or teach them how to work on a CNC machine. You know, we still have a lot of this equipment here. We still do have sophisticated manufacturing going on here, but it's highly automated. What about automation? What about robotics? Somebody's got to work on that stuff. You know, somebody's got to do regular maintenance on this stuff. Why aren't we doing that? Why haven't we said anything like that? You know, I don't know where the tariff money goes. I do know who it costs, though, and it costs you and me.
Right. I think that's a big fallacy. I think people think, oh, the idea that China will have to pay tariffs. China doesn't pay tariffs. Consumers pay tariffs. The buyer of the goods are the ones that have to pay the money. It's not punishing the manufacturing country as much as it is punishing the consumer of the product. It's a penalty for buying that product. And, you know, with the hope that the product will become too expensive and people won't buy it anymore. But, you know, I always, the hair in the back of my neck stands up whenever someone says, I'm glad China's finally paying, you know, tariffs. Like, they're not paying a penny in tariffs. We're paying the tariffs.
We actually had a client wanted to convey a message through us to tell the factory, okay, thanks for quoting that product, but we're not paying those, we're not paying the duty, the tariffs. And the factory said, that's not for us. You don't need to take that up with us. Take it up, you know, with your own government, because we have nothing to do with that. Here's your price when it leaves our factory. Here's the price.
Right. That's all they're
when
getting.
It leaves the shore of China. Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very misunderstood, even by the proponents of tariffs, it's a very misunderstood thing. We finally are having China pay. I'm like, no, yeah, we're not. We're paying. Thank you. We're paying for it. Anyway.
Right. So the other elephant in the room is, I mean, let's just say it has nothing to do with jobs. And maybe I'm being politically incorrect here. But it's all about a reset. It's all about keeping, you know, it's all about world power, and it's all about keeping another country in check. And that's really all it is. And clearly, COVID or no COVID, we've seen the decline. We've seen the decline in exports from China. And we have not seen any increased imports by us. You know, they talk agriculture a lot, but it's really just been a big shift or attempt to reshift power.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot more at play than goods going back and forth. I think the political climate right now is bigger than just do we slap a tariff on steel or whatever. I think it has greater purposes. I totally agree with you there. David Alexander, founder of Baysource Global, thank you so much for being my guest today. I really enjoyed talking to you, and we could have gone on for hours. Maybe after a few months and we get a little either deeper in or closer to being out of this pandemic, we can talk again.
I would enjoy that, Mike. It's been some really thoughtful questions that you posed, and I've enjoyed speaking with you as well and sharing some mutual stories about working over in China. There is a lot of uncertainty. You know, we don't know what we don't know right now. And we don't know what the demand will be for certain things, you know, whether it's consumer products or automobiles, but how that will play into the supply chain, you know, from China is to be determined. I do think that China's going to be factory of the world for a while.
Yeah. And they're not going to give up that badge right now.
No, I don't think so.
No, I agree with you. All right. Well, I do think that this does provide a good opportunity to examine supply chain. I think that that is well-timed. If it wasn't for this pandemic, we may not have done that, and things could have been far worse had this happened later, as we talked about. And it's always good to re-examine and reset when necessary. Whether you're responding to something or you're doing it proactively. So in this case, it's a response, but it still gives, I think, every manufacturing company the ability to take a second look and find out if what they've been doing still makes sense in this pandemic and soon to be post-pandemic world, and how to prepare for the future. So, hey, I appreciate all the insight that you have, and I appreciate your candor. I understand. You mentioned earlier that sometimes you feel like, you know, a hated person from some sections of society. But I do really appreciate your willingness and candor, elephant in the room, you know, acknowledgement, all that kind of stuff. Because China's not going away. China is our partner, whether we like it or not. We rely on China. Even our national security, rare earth minerals, you know, rely on China. So they have to be our partner. And finding ways to work better in that environment, get the politicians out of the middle of it if possible, I think will benefit society in general, not just one country or the other country.
Think of what we could do together if we're working together and not apart.
Yeah, exactly. All right, David Alexander, thank you for being my guest today. I really appreciate it. I will put your contact information in our show notes. So audience, if you want to get a hold of David and find out more about his company and his services, go to the show notes. His contact information and company information will be right there. So again, thanks for joining me, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to Mike@MikeConrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Once again, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.